What in the world happened? This is Michael Brown, but I didn't hear my normal introduction. If you did, I didn't. What was that? Well, welcome to the Line of Fire, friends. I'm trying to sort this out just like you are. 866-348-7884. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Yeah, we played some Jewish music that's normally played later in the show. What happened to our intro telling you that I'm your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution? What happened to giving out the phone number and telling you to join in? And well, I'm just going to have to do it. So welcome to the Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual evolution. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. That means phone lines are open now, as in now. You got a question, a Jewish-related question, any Jewish-related question of any kind, 866-348-7884. That's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. If you have a Jewish-related question, it can relate to the Hebrew language, it can relate to Israel today, it can relate to something in the Old Testament, issues like that. By all means, give us a call. Phone lines are open. Okay. All right. I'll sort things out with the studio. Guys, yeah, everything sent hours ago, lead-ins and all the stuff you all needed. Okay, here we go. Here we go. So I want to talk to you a little bit about the Hebrew language and talk to you a little bit about the question of the law of return, or the right of return, I should say, for Palestinians, and why the U.S. is speaking against that now, as well as sort out some myths versus fact when it comes to Hebrew. So, the Hebrew language, it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, so we're going to start here. The Hebrew language is part of the Semitic language family. Now, in Hebrew, it's Shem. You think Shemitic, but as it comes into English, ultimately we say Semitic. All right? It is one of the Semitic languages. Now, interestingly, when we talk about anti-Semitism, that doesn't mean hatred of the Semitic peoples, because Arabs are Semitic peoples, for example. It doesn't mean hatred of Semitic peoples. It means hatred of Jews. So it's used in different ways. The Semites of old, that's the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the Phoenicians and the Moabites and the Ammonites and people like that, and those living in the Arab kingdoms in the ancient world, and the people of Israel, those are all Semites. When we speak of the Semitic languages, we're talking about all of that family. And then when we talk about anti-Semitism, that has a special meaning, Jew hatred. So just little terminology, interestingly, how Semite can be used differently in one context and another context. Now, the Semitic languages, of which Hebrew is one of the dialects, the Semitic languages have some interesting things in common. Now, here's what's different about them. How many of you have studied a language other than English? Just raise your hands, wave at me. Okay. Did you study a language like Spanish or French or Italian or German? Yeah, or Latin. If you did, you didn't have to learn a new alphabet, did you? Oh, maybe a letter would have a little different pronunciation, or maybe you had to get used to different vowels, like in German, a couple of dots over something called an umlaut. But otherwise, you didn't have to learn a new script, did you? But in the Semitic languages, most of them have different scripts. So that can be challenging. In other words, the Hebrew script, or Hebrew slash Aramaic script, is very different than the Syriac script. And then there are three different types of Syriac script. And then the Syriac script is different from Arabic script. And then the Arabic script is different than, say, the Ethiopic script, different scripts in ancient and modern Ethiopian languages. And these are Semitic languages. And then that's different from the script that was used for the language called Ugaritic, or for what would be called Paleo-Hebrew, an ancient Phoenician script, or the script that was used by the Babylonians and the Assyrians called Akkadian language, which has hundreds of different signs. So when you go from language to language to language in the Semitic languages, you have that challenge that you have to learn a different script to be able to read each one in the original. That's the negative. But there's a positive. There's a redeeming side. The Semitic languages, again, including Hebrew, the Semitic languages have what's called a root system. And most words are based on a three-letter root. And these roots are found largely through the Semitic languages. Now, not constantly. The vocabulary from one language is different than the vocabulary of another language. Or it may mean one thing here and something close to it somewhere else, okay? But if you know one Semitic language, it's easier to move over to another Semitic language because the vocabulary is more in common. You'll find things that are closer together than if you went, say, from English to Spanish to French. You're going to have a lot more diversity in the vocabulary. And often, these roots are found with nouns and with verbs. So, for example, the root katav, meaning to write, or in Arabic, same root kataba, to write, and same in other Semitic languages. So if I say I wrote, I use one form of that word. I'm a writer. I use another form of that word. She will write another. Now, we have the same thing in English. You have write. But if you learn Greek, you'll see in Greek that the roots, the fundamental words, they change dramatically. It's like, huh? That's the same? That's related to this? You can't often tell. In the Hebrew and the Semitic languages, it's much more consistent. So on the one hand, you got the struggle of having to learn a different script each time. Not fun. On the other hand, you have more commonality of vocabulary and even sometimes structure. So it's just, you say, what's that got to do with the price of beans? Well, nothing. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, and I thought I'd tell you some interesting things about Hebrew. But let's go a little further, okay? Let's talk about something that's practical in terms of reading the Bible for yourself. Oh, by the way, let me do this again with a big smile. I've demonstrated in recent weeks how a verse that is always used by Black Hebrew Israelites to say that they are the real Israelites is the verse that makes it clear that they are not the original Israelites, that they cannot be the original Israelites based on this verse, Deuteronomy 28:68. That verse excludes, say, African Americans from saying, we are the original Israelites. That's it. It can't be them. Can't be them. The way that Black Hebrew Israelites try to interpret Deuteronomy 28:68 flatly, plainly does not work just based on the plain sense of the Hebrew. And I've invited folks to call and prove me wrong. I've seen websites offering all this, $100,000 if you can prove this. It's like, it's easy to prove. Now, I haven't taken them up on that anyway, nor do I think that there'd be the integrity and the honesty to acknowledge that it was sufficiently refuted and answered. But my phone lines have been open for weeks now, and I've told our folks, hey, we hear from Black Hebrew Israelites, let me know, and I'm going to do my best to get to them first. Anyway, phone line's still open on that. Just friendly challenge remains. I don't know, it's easier to blast us on YouTube, although the blasting is interesting. The attacks have lessened recently. Yeah, once we laid out some things very plainly, maybe people that are so used to just pushing and in an arrogant, hateful way. I got a very pleasant call last week from someone that identifies as a Black Hebrew Israelite, but rejects a lot of the extremism and says salvation is found only through the blood of Yeshua, etc., and salvation by grace. And we had a pleasant conversation, and I very much appreciated the phone call. But what I often see from that group is an extreme hatred, just like there's been extreme white hatred against blacks in different parts of history. This is extreme black hatred against whites. So again, the hatred exists on all sides, and we expose it wherever we see it. But it's interesting that once we aggressively put some things forward, rather than getting flooded with even more attacks, which I thought might happen, they lessen pretty quickly. Perhaps some have been forced to think about their position a little bit more. Interesting. All right. So let me get into this fallacy here. All right. Let me get into this fallacy. In the 1980s, I learned that in Word of Faith circles, that there was a teaching about a so-called permissive tense in Hebrew. Now, the wording was completely wrong because tense has to do with time, past, present, future, etc. So it wouldn't be a permissive tense, it would be a permissive sense in Hebrew. But the allegation was when God would say, for example, that I will smite you, what he meant is I will permit you to be smitten, and that he never actively took responsibility for this. And this is how certain Word of Faith teachers reconciled their belief that God was a healer, which I utterly affirm, with these verses that talk about God smiting and destroying and killing. How could that be? Well, the answer is very simple, that in judgment, he acts righteously and brings judgment. Just like it's righteous to put certain people in jail or to sentence someone to life in prison without parole, or in certain cases to a death penalty, it's righteous to do that. And at least we would agree, in certain cases, life in prison without parole, it's righteous. Well, God righteously judges. And he absolutely has the right to as the perfect judge. So sometimes he judges the guilty and he smites them in different ways, consistent with his character. But the bottom line is there is no such animal as this so-called permissive sense. Permissive tense. It doesn't exist. It does not exist in the Hebrew language anywhere. It's a myth. I think it's still around. Probably the myth is still around. Dealt with it decades ago. I guess it's still around, but just in case it is, it's a myth, friends. Okay. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. And here's what I'm going to do. I was waiting for that music. I'm going to take a break.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. All right, I'm looking online to make sure I can make this special announcement now. I've got to be sure it's up and running on my website. Number to call if you've got a Jewish-related question, 866-348-7884. Okay, it's here. I got big news. It's not directly related to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but it's big news. I am really stoked and excited about this. This is the first announcement I'm making now on the radio about this. All right, are you ready? Okay. You know, I've written a lot about President Trump. You know, I passionately opposed him during the primaries. When I saw he was going to win and I thought, am I missing something? Is something else happening? Is God at work? Perhaps. Either way, I knew when it was Trump versus Hillary that I couldn't vote for Hillary. Could I vote for Trump? I processed all that, ultimately voted for him, recognized God doing great things through him, significant things through him, major things through him, and other things because of his flawed humanity are very destructive. How do we relate? How do we respond? As evangelicals, if we stand with him, is that a marriage made in heaven, or is that a match made in heaven, or a marriage with hell? So a couple weeks back, I got stirred, friends, in prayer. I mean, stirred in prayer. Get a book out and get it out before the midterm elections. Here's the title of the book: Donald Trump is Not My Savior. An evangelical leader speaks his mind about the man he supports as president. And I have written brand new material, the opening chapter, where I dig into this. Is this relationship, evangelicals and Trump, is this a match made in heaven or is it marriage with hell? I end the book with where do we go from here? Clear guidelines as to how we can live in a godly way and participate in the political system, and even guidelines going into the midterm elections and the 2020 elections. And then I took every relevant article I've written on Donald Trump and put it in chronological order. I mean, you'll go with me on that journey of my opposition, my questions, my concerns, my tentative support, the good, the bad, the one hand recognizing how God's using him, you know, for Israel and the Jewish people, and religious liberty in America and the courts and so on. On the other hand, divisive, destructive aspects of his personality that tarnish our reputation as we stand with him. So here's the exciting news. Okay, and guys, we got a banner up on our website we can point to, all right? So here's the exciting news. The paperback is coming out October 23rd. There'll be Kindle, so ebook, and then an audiobook as well. But we are having an exclusive printing, just 500 copies, an exclusive hardcover printing. You won't be able to get this anywhere else right now. But that's number one. Number two, every copy will be numbered. So 1, 2, 5, 100, 200, 300. And I'll sign it and put a scripture verse in. So I'll actually sign it to you personally. I mean, I do this. It's one of my great joys. It takes a while, but we get the books all piled up on a desk. And it's only the second time now that we've ever done it, though, with a special exclusive hardcover. All right? So this is the first 500 exclusive hardcover, numbered and signed. And it's the order in which you get it. So go to my website right now. It's right on the homepage, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Go there today and click. You may be number one. You may be number five. I've come up to people on the road, even overseas. They'll say, I was number 206. I was number 14. Every so often I've met, I was number one. But each one, I'm telling you, sign it to your name. You may want to get it as a gift for someone. Say, sign it to so-and-so. It's my joy. So you're supporting our ministry. You're helping us do exactly what we're doing now. That's one. And two, we are getting something very special to you, kind of a collector's item. So it's blessed all around. So again, this is exclusively the hardcover, signed, numbered, and hopefully we'll get it to you before it gets out to the general public on October 23rd. Certainly by then, but hopefully before that. So go to the website right now. Be among the very first. We haven't posted this link on social media now. So you hearing, watching, you're the very first to know about this link. AskDrBrown.org. Go ahead, order it today, as many copies as you want, the exclusive hardcover edition. Donald Trump is not my savior. An evangelical leader speaks his mind about the man he supports as president. You say, well, it sounds like you're for him, you're against him. It's what? Well, friends, you know where I stand. You know where I stand. My ultimate allegiance is to the Lord. I will not tarnish my witness for Jesus by standing with someone with that same kind of allegiance outside of the Lord. On the flip side, I recognize God using Donald Trump. If the elections were today and it was him versus Hillary Clinton, I'd vote for him. If the midterm elections were today, I would vote for candidates that are supporting his agenda for pro-life Supreme Court justices, for family, and to push back against radical LGBT activism, to stand for our religious liberties, to stand with Israel. I'd vote for candidates that stood with that agenda. And at the same time, when the president calls a journalist a degenerate fool, I'll say, I don't like that. That's wrong. That is degrading and demeaning and divisive and helps no one. I'll be honest. I'll speak the truth in love. That's what we do in this book. And I'm really psyched. You say, how are you getting out this quick? It's a crazy thing. Publisher, we all heard from the Lord together to do it. That's how it's happening this quickly. And you'll see, it's a gorgeous cover, too. It is. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. To the phones we go. Tim in Colorado, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can, loud and clear.
Okay, great. I had a question about replacement theology.
I haven't
really thought about that very much, but I've seen a few excerpts from some debates you've had on that issue. And I'm Jewish, but I'm also a Christian. And I'm wondering if it's possible to harmonize both sides, or if in your mind this isn't a harmonization at all. But my question is, and the example I'm thinking in my head is, if I had a will, and in my will I bequeathed everything to my children,
mm-hmm.
to be divided up between them,
right.
And then over time, after the will was written, I adopted other children, and they became part of my family, and then I died, it would make sense to me that the expectation would be that those, everything that was to be divided equally between my children would be divided between all my children, and
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't see that as replacing what I'm giving to my children, my natural born
children. All right, so tell you what, let's explore that, okay? And
yeah.
I work together with other Christians that hold to replacement theology. I teach at seminaries where some of the profs hold to replacement theology. I'd get side by side with someone who held to replacement theology to win the lost and to fight against abortion and to reach the world with missions in a heartbeat. So in other words, I'm not going to divide and refuse to acknowledge someone as a brother or sister or work with them for the gospel. So my heart is all for working together. Your question is, can there be theological reconciliation? So let's throw out a few scenarios, okay? Would you agree with me that if the adopted children displace your biological children, we have a problem?
Yes.
Okay, so that's replacement theology. That's the essence of it.
Right.
Right.
And I would not. Go ahead.
Right. Right. So, in other words, let's just say that when quote the church, which is largely Gentile, receives the promises that were once given to the people of Israel, and the people of Israel can't get them anymore unless they become part of the church, they have now been displaced. So we agree with that. That's first thing. Second thing, what if you had one house that was the family house, okay, and you bequeathed that to your firstborn son, but you also had lots and lots of other surrounding property, and that was going to be equally divided among the rest of your children, and those children said, no, but we all want that house. Would that be right?
No.
Okay, so that's the same thing. God promised the physical land of Israel to the Jewish people, to the people of Israel, period. He did not promise that to anybody else. Others that were physically joined with them could live there with them, but promised that to them. And then he said that the meek will inherit the whole world. And that Paul writes, so Jesus quotes the Psalms, Paul writes that the whole world is yours, right? So everybody gets to inherit something, but that specific place was given to Israel. So I have no problem sharing the promises. We do share the promises. I have no problem saying that the spiritual blessings that were offered to Israel are offered to the entire world. As long as they don't get stolen from Israel and the things that were specifically promised to Israel don't get taken away. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I don't know if you would place what I'm presenting. I'm not saying this is what I believe, but it's something I'm pondering. But I don't know if you would characterize what I'm saying as replacement theology, or if you would say it's not, or if it's something completely different between the two opposing views. But I guess I do want to qualify a little bit with what I said when I said I agreed with you. I would say if one of my natural-born children decides they don't want to be part of the family anymore for whatever reason, then I would assume that they would not receive what's in the will.
So here's got to jump in because I got a break. Of course, they miss out on the blessings. But if your will said, I don't care what you do, I don't care if you disinherit me, I don't care, this house is always yours in perpetuity, then it's still theirs legally, even because that's what you decreed. So God decreed that for Israel, regardless of Israel's sin or disobedience, when he made the promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it was before the law was given at Sinai, and the promise was unconditional. So that would be the difference in the analogy. But the biggest thing is eternal salvation that only comes through faith in Jesus. For Jew or Gentile, doesn't matter. Thank you.
Fire we want, for fire we please. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Welcome, welcome to the broadcast, 866-348-7884. In recent days, we have heard American leadership say that in negotiations with the Palestinians, we are officially saying that we do not believe in the so-called right of return. You say, what? That's cruel. That's terrible. Let me give you a context. Over the last century, there have been many large-scale people displacements, be it in Eastern Europe, be it in the Middle East, be it in other parts of the world. And for example, when the modern state of Israel was founded in 1948, Jews living in surrounding Muslim lands, about 800,000 Jews had to flee for their lives, and the great majority came to Israel. Do they all have the right to go back to Morocco or to Tunisia or to Yemen or to whatever other countries they came from? No, no one talks about that, do they? Why would they? And if you look at, you know, when Serbia and Croatia and the Balkan states and different things, and this one left here, or just lots of issues with the former Soviet Union, Germany, and so on, there have been a lot of people groups displaced. Those who identify as the Palestinians are one of them in the war with Israel in 1947, 1948, the war that was started by the surrounding Arab Muslim nations. So what's happened is that in every other case, the people have now resettled. The people are now moving forward with their future. They're no longer refugees. But when it comes to the Palestinians, they're still considered refugees. And those that left, they may be living in America now. They may be living in Saudi Arabia. Who knows where else? They may be living in Syria. Now they've multiplied. Now they've grown from several hundred thousand to millions. And they say, well, okay, we all have the right to come back, and we have to have land again. That's completely bogus. That is contrary to every other major people displacement resettlement example in the last century, and it's utterly impossible. And again, the problem was created when the state of Israel was not recognized. So it's a terrible wound that was inflicted, but it's a self-inflicted wound. No. There is no right of return. For those that chose to stay, whatever help can be extended to them so that their lives can be fruitful and prosperous and they can have the ability to self-determine their future, wonderful. They just need to do is renounce all leadership that wants to destroy Israel and say, let's live side by side. Israel will be very happy to do that. 866-34-TRUTH. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish answers. In fact, before I go to the phones, let me respond to a question by Jonathan on Twitter. Does the prophetic significance of Israel mean we should ignore possible atrocities caused by the modern state, nation state of Israel? Is there room for God to be passionate about his people and for his people and their elected leaders to still make grave mistakes? How to respond? Acknowledging that there is significant anti-Israel bias in the media. We can't believe everything we hear, but we also can't believe sinful man is not making mistakes. Jonathan, great question and phrased very graciously. Oh, I will regularly speak out against what I believe Israel's doing wrong as a nation. There is absolutely wrong within Israel. Here, let's just think about it. Let's think of secular Israel. Let's think of secular Israel where women serving in the IDF, serving in the military, can get free abortions. How should we feel about that as followers of Jesus? How about the fact that ultra-Orthodox Jews, maybe 15% of the population, militantly oppose the gospel, and in one case within the last couple of years, rounded up New Testaments that had been distributed in one community and burned them? I mean, it's the Nazis that burned Jewish books. A lot of Israelis were not happy with ultra-Orthodox Jews burning New Testaments. How should we feel about that? And what about the radical settlers who hate the Palestinians and who commit acts of violence against them? What should we say to that? And what about mistreatment that's existed for some Jews who've come from Africa. Some Ethiopians mistreated, some racism. Not everywhere, but it's existed. Of course we grieve over that, and we speak out against it. How about Tel Aviv being voted the most gay-friendly city in the world? What do we say to that? So Israel's far from perfect. And as a friend of Israel, I say it. Now, that has nothing to do whatsoever with me believing God brought the Jewish people back to the land. He did, according to Scripture and according to theological logic. It's the only plausible answer that God did it. So I say that while still recognizing our people's sin and need the Messiah. And as a true friend, look, I have no better friend in the world than my wife, Nancy. And nobody corrects me more than my wife, Nancy. And nobody points out my faults to me more than my wife, Nancy. Nobody. There's not anybody within 100 miles or 1,000 miles or 1,000,000 miles of her degree of giving input into my life and speaking truth to me in love, but this is wrong or this should change or I forgot to do this or whatever it is. And that's because we're so close. So true friends will do that. So I will absolutely stand on this hill, come what may, and say God brought the Jewish people back to the land. And it's essential that we recognize that. And then I will agree when Israel does wrong. But you're absolutely right, Jonathan. There's a ton of media bias. There's a ton of misreporting. There's a ton of misinformation. And in many ways, Israel stands out in its treatment of others and in the efforts that it makes to preserve human life in the midst of war. In many ways, Israel is exemplary. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to the phones, and we'll go to Orlando, Florida. Stephen, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, what's going on, Dr. Brown?
Hey, man. All good?
So I had a question. Judaism, grew up Christian my whole life, but I've heard a couple refutes towards Paul and Jesus, mainly towards Paul, but it was basically their background and their teaching. And, I guess the background of how they taught, maybe it wasn't traditional Judaism that they grew up as, and maybe it seemed like it was more Roman or Greek or I don't know. I'm not familiar with the detail that they went into, but that was just one thing that caught my attention.
Yeah, so let's answer this on two levels. Number one, all of the best historians, all of the top scholars of ancient Judaism recognize that the teaching of Jesus can only be understood when placed in an ancient Jewish context, that many of the debates in the Gospels can only be understood when placed in an ancient Jewish context, that Jesus' method of teaching was the method that was often used by the later rabbis, that his method of legal reasoning was similar to that. I'll just give you one tiny example. In Matthew chapter 19, the Pharisees come to him, wanting to bring him in to a controversy and say, is it right to divorce a woman for any and every reason? Well, why would they be asking him this? Well, because the two major Pharisaical groups, and what I'm saying now is totally known to anyone who knows any Jewish background to the New Testament. The two major Pharisaic groups at that time were Beit Hillel, which became the predominant one, and Beit Shammai, the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai. And the house of Hillel taught that you could divorce a woman for any and every reason. And this was also considered compassionate. If you don't love her anymore, if you hate her, divorce her. And that the house of Shammai said only for sexual immorality, only in the case of adultery. And they wanted to bring Jesus into their dispute. So they were asking him about a first century Jewish legal dispute. And he answers, and his answer is in harmony with the view of Shammai. And even the ideal he puts forth, don't let anyone divide what God's brought together, makes clear that divorce was only something that God put in and into the law, Deuteronomy 24, because of the hardness of our heart. So when it comes to the teaching of Jesus, the only way to legitimately understand him is to put him in the context of a great Jewish teacher in the first century, but yet one who transcended the traditions of his day and spoke with divine authority. Now, when it comes to Paul, here's what's interesting. There are some who tried to say, well, Jesus was okay. Paul started Christianity. But all the major themes of Paul, his emphasis on the death and resurrection of Messiah, the Messiah's atoning sacrifice on our behalf, all of these things, they are emphasized not just in Paul, but in other New Testament writers, but in the lips of Jesus himself. All right. And the idea that Paul turned Jesus into a God. Well, the Gospel of John has the clearest statements anywhere about the deity of Jesus. Whole books have been written. David Wenham has two books, one more detailed than the other, about Paul and Jesus, showing that Paul was a faithful and loyal disciple. Not only so, when you look in the book of Acts, you see that Paul continues to live as a Jew, and whatever synagogue he shows up in, he's able to speak to the Jewish community because they recognize him as a Jew, so obviously in his dress and lifestyle, and he's able to communicate because that's the world that he came out of. And the end of the book of Acts, the 28th chapter, he's talking to the Jewish leaders in Rome about Jesus being the Messiah, and he's a fellow Jew talking to them. So more and more scholars in recent decades have recognized that Paul also must be understood in his Jewish context, and that if we take him out of a Jewish context and just put him exclusively in a Greek context, that his teaching will not make as much sense either. And for example, when he talks about, when he's writing to Timothy, he's talking about people opposing the gospel, and he references, just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, who are they? Well, according to Jewish tradition, those were the names of some of the Egyptian magicians. So he gets that from Jewish tradition, the Egyptian tradition, magicians who opposed Moses and Aaron. Or, for example, in 1 Corinthians 10, when he talks about there was a rock that followed Israel in the wilderness, and that rock was the Messiah, and from that rock they got water. Well, there's an ancient Jewish tradition that there was a literal rock that followed Israel in the wilderness, and that was part of the provision for water, etc. So Paul makes reference to another ancient Jewish tradition, and he references it to the Corinthians, who may have heard some of this teaching in the synagogue, and says, actually, that rock, that was the Messiah traveling with Israel. So volume four, sir, of my series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, volume four, I counter these objections head on in detail. It's volume four of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to The Line of Fire. I'm Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let me tell you something interesting about the Hebrew language before I go back to the phones and some of your Twitter questions that have been posted. Hebrew is very different than Greek. Hebrew is more concrete, Greek more abstract. I'm speaking broadly. Language is language, and things have to be conveyed in ways that are clear. But Greek thought and working with the language can be more abstractly expressed. Hebrew tends to express things in more concrete images. And Greek is much more precise when it comes to verbal tenses. It can express things much more concisely about this is past completed action, this is future incomplete action, etc. It has more verbal tenses, whereas Hebrew is much more fluid. And when it comes to poetry, very fluid. And what you must do is not just look at the grammar, but also look at the context to get the larger flow in Hebrew. And that's also why even something called a subjunctive, right? Is this subjunctive or not in Hebrew? Should we use the would word in there? I would have done this if I could have. We can say that easily in English. To convey that in Hebrew is much more difficult to make that utterly clear. Sometimes you'll be reading in the Psalms, and like Psalm 72, Is that a just a prayer? May his kingdom, the kingdom of Solomon, and ultimately a type of Messiah, may his kingdom grow and prosper and expand? Or is it a prophecy? His kingdom will grow and prosper and expand. It's totally debatable based on Hebrew, whereas you could express things with more precision in Greek. Again, this is by God's choice and wisdom in terms of how he has revealed himself in Scripture. Here's a Twitter question from JS. How can the church adopt some Jewish practices and go back to the early sect of Christianity? Well, Gentile Christians did not necessarily adopt that many Jewish practices. They may have if they had background where they came to faith in a synagogue like some of the Corinthian believers. They're already God-fearing Gentiles, familiar with Sabbath, familiar with the Hebrew calendar, biblical calendar. They may have been more inclined to do these things. But there's no evidence, for example, when the gospel went to the Thessalonians and Paul's talking to them about turning from idols to the one true living God, that they then were going to keep a seventh-day Sabbath or keep the dietary laws or the Jewish traditions and practices. So what each group has to do, 1 Corinthians 7 is very clear. If you were called, meaning saved, called to salvation, circumcised, don't become uncircumcised. If you're called Jewish and there are Jewish aspects to your life that are important, don't become a Gentile. And if you're called uncircumcised, as a Gentile, don't become circumcised. Don't feel the need to become Jewish to draw closer to the Lord. Now, if you say, boy, I enjoy being part of a Messianic Jewish congregation. I love the teaching there, and I love the Jewish roots and background. Great, as long as Jesus Yeshua remains central, as long as he remains central, adored as Lord, fine, if God calls you to that. But don't think that you're going to be more authentically a disciple if you take on certain Jewish practices. In fact, many Jewish practices people take in are things that were centuries after the time of Jesus. All right, let's see here. Let's go to James in Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my call again.
You know what? So you must be slipping past the call screeners because I'm looking. It's like, James in Phoenix, we just talked. But anyhow, somehow they must have just been slipping a little bit, but their loss is your gain. Go for it.
So my question was on the Isaiah 7:14, where in the Hebrew, all the verbiage in there is like in the perfect tense, but in the King James, it's all like in the future tense, like she shall conceive and...
Are you sure it's in the perfect tense, sir?
In Isaiah 7:14?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, in the Hebrew, it looks like it's all in the perfect tense. It's not like it doesn't have the prefixes to show that it's in the imperfect.
What if it's participial? What if it's what we would say is present tense? Hinehal maharavio, let it ben. Behold, the Alma, the maiden, the virgin, is pregnant and about to have a son. That would be the most legitimate way to translate it. So on what basis would it be understood to be future? That would just be that it's a prophetic pronouncement. So the question is there such a thing as prophetic perfect, where something is spoken of in the past and is actually for the future? Oh, yeah, absolutely. In other words, the prophet sees it as if it already happened. Let's just picture here that I got caught up in a vision and I said, and President Trump was elected to a second term in 2020 and it was a landslide victory, or President Trump was voted out in 2020. And in other words, I'm seeing the headlines of the day after, right? But I'm seeing it in the future. So the clearest example is probably Numbers chapter 24:17. And there you have the rabbinic commentaries, Jewish commentaries like Rashi, who's the foremost commentator, explaining that this would be what we call the prophetic perfect. So it says in 24:17, a well-known prophecy, all right? He says, I see him, but not now. I glimpse at him, but it's not near. Darach Kokav Miyakov. A star will stride forth from Jacob, but the Hebrew is perfect. It has done it. A star has stepped forth from Jacob. That's what was written. So And then at the end, and he will smite the forehead of the Moabites. That's past tense. We say he will, but the Hebrew says he has done it. Then Rashi gives some other examples. Yeah, so look at Numbers 24:17, and you'll see that's perfect. That's all in the perfect. That's all spoken of as past, but we rightly translate it as future, because the prophet is seeing it in advance as if it already happened. Just picture it like this, that I give you the Super Bowl score, you know? Carolina Panthers defeat the, New England Patriots again, 13-6 in the Super Bowl. A great game for Cam Newton. I'm reading the headlines the day after of the next Super Bowl next year as if it already happened. Mm. So that's the prophetic vision. So they say it as past because they are seeing it as it already happened. And that's how we understand Isaiah 53 as prophetic perfect. It's saying, who believed our report? He grew up, he did all this. Even though it's future, they're talking about it as if it already happened. As for Isaiah 7:14, I believe it's best to understand that there is something imminent. There is something spoken of some level, some sign of some importance in that day, but it does not reach its final fulfillment in terms of supernatural birth and the significance of this child until the Messiah comes. Many messianic prophecies are like that. Isaiah 9:6 is the other one you want to look at. Prophetic perfect. Is it speaking about the birth of Hezekiah and he just doesn't live up to things, or is it speaking in the future about the birth of the Messiah? In the Hebrew, Yelad Yulad Lano Bendi Tanlano, that's all perfect. That's all past tense. So yes, prophetic perfect exists. Hey, thank you, sir, for the call. Glad you slipped through our call screeners again, man. All right. In case you missed this announcement earlier, I'm really psyched about this. I have a book that is coming out. I just felt led just 2 weeks ago. I got to get it out before the midterms. The whole thing has come together. It's gorgeous. The cover is amazing. 352 pages. My brand new book, Donald Trump Is Not My Savior. An evangelical leader speaks his mind about the man he supports as president. Now, here's the deal. You'll be able to order it any of the normal places you do online. It'll be paperback and ebook and even audiobook. But we have an exclusive printing, just 500 copies. We're printing in hardcover, okay? We rarely do it, but we decided to do it this time. Here's how you get it. We're gonna number the first 500 copies. I'm going to sign each one. So if it's James from Phoenix, to James. Yeah, it's actually me that signs it, right? To James. I'll put a scripture reference in and sign it. And you alone will get these hardcovers, okay? It's an exclusive printing that we're doing. 500 hardcovers of the brand new book, Donald Trump Is Not My Savior. And in this book, not only do I have brand new material answering the question, evangelicals and Donald Trump, is this a match made in heaven or marriage with hell? And not only do I give guidelines for where we're going in the future and even how to handle the next elections, midterm in 2020 as believers, okay? But every relevant article I wrote about Donald Trump in the last 3 years, about 90 articles, every single one of them is there. And we put them in chronologically so you can kind of go on the journey together and groan and lie. Were you right? Were you wrong? How should we respond? And so we are really excited. Fabulous work with the publisher to get the book out. So to pre-order the exclusive hardcover signed numbered edition, go right now to my website. It's the only place to get this hardcover signed numbered pre-order. And we'll do our best to get it to you before it comes out on October 23rd, the official release date. Go to my website now, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. You can get as many copies as you want, by the way. But if you order multiple copies, just tell us who you want them to sign, who you'd like us to sign them to. All right? So this way we can personalize every single one of them. And one of my favorite things is to come in. It's a lot to do, but to come in. And they've got them, we take one desk and we just pile them high. And then sometimes it takes a couple days or three to get through all of them, but we get them out as quickly as possible. So askdrbrown.org, you'll see the banner right there on the homepage. Back with you tomorrow. Looking forward to answering your questions.